This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Fine Dining, the search for the most mediocre restaurant in America, is a podcast where comedian Michael Ornelas is traveling the country, eating at all chain restaurants in search of the perfectly average 5.0 out of 10 dining experience, the objective middle threshold of where bad becomes good. Friend of the Doughboys, Marissa Pinson and John Glover were the most recent guests as they reviewed Costco's Food Court. It's a two-part episode that covers everything from discontinued menu items to how many Costco hot dogs they could fit in their mouths. Damn, I wish I was on that episode. I'd crush that. Head over to linktree.com/finediningpodcast, FINEDININGPODCAST, and click B's giveaway to enter a giveaway for an all-expenses-paid trip to your local Applebee's, the current frontrunner for the most mediocre restaurant in America at 5.02 out of 10, for you and up to three of your friends. And you can watch or listen to Fine Dining on your platform of choice while you're there. Enter by May 1st, and the winner will be announced on the May 8th episode. Disclaimer, $50 will be provided for transportation along with a $200 Applebee gift card. I love doing those fast read disclaimer things. Go give Fine Dining a listen, the search for the most mediocre restaurant in America. What's up, shitheads? Welcome back to another episode of High and Mighty. It's me, your boy, the number one fuckboy, John Gaber, standing 6'2", 294 pounds. That's right, you heard it, folks. He's under 300 pounds for the first time in a while. From the South Shore of Nassau County, Long Island, it's Johnny G. All you gotta do is trust me. Jackson, Maine, from A Star Is Born, Gabers, you need to see a new movie. Maybe I'll start doing the maestro. Also joining me in the High and Mighty Studios, my newly signed co-host Arthur Gabris. Arthur, give him a shout out. Arthur, not actually in the studio today. Also joining me in the High and Mighty Studios, returning guest, you know him, you love him, Bum Vulture, and now a newly christened author. We got Jesse David Fox.
Hi.
I was going to make like a fox noise, but in that moment I realized like a wolf is a howl, a dog is a bark. What?
Foxes, I believe, make like little squawks. I don't think they don't roar. They're like, I think they're like little dogs, if I remember.
I got correctly. A song idea. It's like, what does the fox say? I'll work on a beat and come up with something for it.
Yeah.
Dude, congratulations on a fucking book.
Thank you so much.
Out now?
Yes, it came out it's out now. It came out November 7th.
Hell yeah, my wife's birthday.
Which is like, you start these books, it'll be almost four years from when I first had a conversation about I'm going to now start working on a book.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I could tell you about the amount of conversations I've had about starting something, and that in 4 years, 4 years come and gone, and I haven't even made a fucking inch. So, yeah. Congratulations, man. This is like a project. Books stress me out. Like, I have enough friends that have written books that it just, I can't even, like, getting like a 30-page spec together is like impossible. Books seem so much more overwhelming.
Yeah, it's like you procrastinate as much as possible. Like, my writing style was like, okay, I'll do research, and that counts. But then I realized I was doing research to stuff so tangential just so I didn't have to start writing.
Yeah,
I was like,
let me watch Delirious and Raw again.
Yeah, that will be relevant. Like, I don't talk about it, but maybe. And then, like, I was reading, like, Lenny Bruce's biography, and it's like, and I was like, okay, well, that will inform. And then I was just truly just reading books about wit and, like, old academic texts. And I was like, I just have to write a word. I just have to write one word down, which will be the first word of the book, whatever it is. And then knowing, I'm probably going to cut it all out, but I just need to start doing a thing.
This has a lot of carryover to the rest of our conversation, but keep going, because this is literally how I'm looking at working on stand-up. It's like, just have to do it. At some point, you just have to start. Yeah.
Like, there's writers who are more organized than I am, both, like, literally and, like, how their process works. But, like, okay, let me map out this whole book and, like, okay, well, here are all the things I'm going to be touching on, so then this can tie into that, and then, like, I'll map out the chapters and, like, I think partly because I started as a blogger, like I only know how to write first word forward. So I just I would I had a list of things. I'm like, well, this will just go in this order. It would be like, actually, it's not on like a set list, right? So it's like, you have a book, you have a name of a thing. You're like, cool. All right. So I'm starting with Jerry Seinfeld. And I know I need to get to like this essay about how you can't cut up dead frogs. And somewhere in between will be this. And I'm just going to be writing in that direction. And be like, and now I'm there. Like that. And ultimately, what I realized halfway through was like, I'm going to be editing. This is it's actually from talking to Dan Harmon, because Dan Harmon realized this with his scripts, which is like, he edits good first drafts as much as bad first drafts. So you might as well write a bad first draft that takes a third of the time as writing a good first draft.
Yes, yes. I'm on board with that. A lot of people in the industry will call it like a vomit draft. Just get it on the paper and then start molding it.
So yeah. I would yada yada 3,000 word sections. I'd just be like, start. It's like, okay, yada yada, I'll write about Bo Burnham. And then like next thing you know, it's like, then I'd on my second pass, like, now I have to write this, but now it's a future person. You know, I keep on passing the problem on. And then next thing you know, you're like, I had 150,000 word first draft, which was, my editor told me like the book is going to run at like 90,000 words. And I wrote 150,000 words. And I was like, I wonder if I can get him to read this one. And he's like, I will not read anything over 100,000 words.
Whoa.
I was like, okay, got to cut out 50,000 words.
Got to cut a third of my fucking book out. Yeah. And this is not like me. I'd be changing the margins a little, you know, double space, like doing that. None of that shit works. That's too much. You have to actually get a lot of it gone.
You have to be like, what is actually am I talking about? And then it's just like, but God once help. You get it down, then at least you know what you're working from. So it's so much easier to squeeze and whatever. But like to write a first word of a thing that's going to be 90,000 words, like, is an impossible thing. So that's why I had to just accept, like, what is a thing that is like a thing I'm going to do? And maybe I'll start with this. And it was like, it was honestly like the first, and it's not even in the book at all, but like the first thing I did was defend that I got to write a book.
Right, right. Which is funny because we kind of talked about this off air before we jumped on. But I wanted to say, like, I know there are people, there are literal people who are like, you can't be a comedy reviewer without having done stand up or being a stand. And to me, I love, like, I'm old enough that I read film critics, that I watched Ebert and, you know, I watched Siskel and Ebert growing up, and I respected them because I respected their taste. And honestly, that's how I came to know you, was I enjoyed how you talked about comedy. And honestly, we need more outsiders looking in, because it's hard. Like, I'm not going to fucking post like, you know, Rich Voss's stand up was kind of, like, I mean, I have a lot of stand ups I love, but you're not going to catch
Rich,
me.
And Rich Voss, it's so funny that Rich, imagine just like, okay, I'm going to start doing comedy criticism. Rich Voss.
I know. Yeah. Like, just kick the hornet's nest day one. So I appreciate what you do already. I guess I find it hard to believe, or I guess I find it crazy that there aren't more people doing what, I mean, the arts have been exploded in the last 100 years, and art criticism is kind of like went the way of guys on YouTube pointing out Easter eggs or whatever. But I'm glad to see there's some, I mean, you write for a print publication. Yeah. Like that's like, that alone is like a dream. But the idea that someone is out and I guess there's an element of sort of like the doors have been closed to comedy has blown up, and it's like a huge live performance comedy is like bigger than ever before. And as TV and streaming and all this shit gets fucking shattered even more, I feel like it is going to be performers are leaning on it even more for their finances and for the artistic fulfillment.
Yeah.
And it's such an insular world that it needs someone from the outside who has a breadth of knowledge and has seen a bunch and thought critically about it that also has zero skin in the game. Like, you know what I mean? Like for you to like be like if you were a guy who was a stand up, but you also booked weekly, you know, I'd be like, it's a little, he's going to have favors. That's what I like about this area that you're in. And so I'm so appreciative of it. And like,
thank you.
Previous guest Jesse was on previously, we talked about SNL as like sports, which I kind of stuck with for a really long time, didn't realize I was doing it, But much like sports, sometimes your team gets so bad that you're happy to have your Sundays free. I'm kind of in the Saturday evenings are free. I'll watch some highlights, watch some weekend update. But
is not crazy. I mean, like, I remember I talked to Seth Meyers like right after he left, and he's like, I still watch, but I don't stay up on Saturday to watch. I'll see what's I was like. One, it's some cast members can't watch, but he still cared. He watched it like sports. He loved that piece too. But he's like, yeah, I'm going to watch clips. I have a kid, or like I'm a grown up. I'm not going to stay up until 1 o'clock on a Saturday for no reason.
Yeah, it's just like me now. I'm like, I'll watch the Giants highlights. I can't sit through a 3-hour game. It's too stressful. It's like, and I do have less like personal friends on the show than ever before too. So that helps.
It's like watching the NBA now where I'm like, these kids. were not born when 9/11 happened.
I know. These kids who are on SNL now were not alive when I got rejected by SNL.
Your rejection is older than current cast members.
Yeah, a dream.
Yeah.
My Ronnie from Jersey Shore impression really didn't pierce through to the crowd over there. But the topic at hand is stand-up comedy, because I too have a bit, I'm like a half outsider perspective on this, in that I've always been a fan of stand-up since I was a kid. And when I got into comedy, I thought that was the only thing. And then I found improv and sketch in college and was like, oh, okay, this is more in my wheelhouse because it's like team stuff and I like collaborating. But in the last couple of years, since I've always done some solo stuff, some character storytelling, but since the pandemic, I was like, what the fuck is improv? Like, I wish I could just tour by myself. I wish like someone would go like, Gabrus, do you want to open for me in Stockholm or whatever? So like, there's like, I want this skill set. And it's also something that makes me nervous, which I don't feel that frequently in performance anymore. So something that gives me nerves, I have like this, I'm 41. My life is pretty soft. So if I can find something that gets me a little anxious, like like camping, like stuff that I'm like, this is actually a little more difficult than I'm used to. So stand up gets me in that space. So, and I've been doing it more and more. And when you were like, I wanted to do the pod, I'm like, I feel like this is perfect because it's changed so much. It's going to change even more. There's so many strong opinions, so many strong camps and stuff like that, that I was like, oh, I'd love to get into it. Get into it a little bit.
I will say, like, I can't remember. The first time I ever saw improv, it was at DCM, and is either you, the first improv I've ever seen was, I believe, either you or Doppelganger. I can't remember which show opened that DCM, but it was you with like Ben Rogman and
Ben Rogers and Gavin Spieler.
Yeah.
Outlook of the Poet was the name of that. We used to do improvised one act plays.
So that was a DCM. The first time I ever saw improv was, I believe, either you or that. And then if not, you were the second improv I've ever seen. So like, you are when I think improv, I think of you.
Oh, go
so,
good.
So that's, but that's what I wanted to talk about, because it's like the transition to stand up happens, but it's, the shifts are so subtle, and I don't think people talk about it from the perspective that I find interesting, which is sort of like, what is your relationship to the audience? Like, why, you know, because I think a lot of people would be surprised, they'd be nervous. It's like, you talk right now as yourself, you've done, performed on stage, and it's like, but there's, and I think that nervousness is like essential to like what makes stand-up work. And like, I think the best comedians find ways to keep on being nervous when they are working.
Yeah.
And I think the most disappointing comedians are the comedians who figure out a way to not feel nervous anymore and realize like, oh, this is really cool. I could be famous and not be nervous. I'll just do that.
Yeah. There's an element, like, I guess what words we're not using are like pushing yourself, or like, you know, like
or being
taking
vulnerable.
A leap. Vulnerability. Yeah. Yeah. I think part of why stand-up makes me nervous is because I haven't done it ever, but I've been a fan of it for so long. I guess there's like that Ira Glass quote that comes to mind where he's like, if you've been a fan of something for so, like, I have a high standard in my head for stand-up. And so I've gotten really good at improv and like live performance outside of stand-up. So I have this like in my head of like, fuck, I can't be bad, like I don't want to be bad. So then I'm like, oh, I'm overthinking it. I think I'm taking, and I finally had to just get to the point where I'm like, no one's fucking thinking like, this guy I thought was really good at improv and now he's bombing at stand-up. Like, no one cares. But and as a matter of fact, I feel like half the time I go up at stand-up shows when they're real venues, they don't even know me as an improviser, so it doesn't fucking matter. But I've been like in my head about that because I'm like, oh, well, you know, Rory Scovel, blah, blah, like, you know, like, and I'm like, stop choosing like people who are the best.
But also the best bomb, if they, the best comedians allow themselves to still bomb, even though they don't, they cannot bomb. Like Rory, I think, is a great example because like Rory does those improvised shows, right?
Where he when goes you up said with someone who makes themselves like Rory came to mind because he's someone I idolize as a stand up and like. His style of stand-up is so, I think I could, if of a style I could emulate, it's that, because it's this kind of, I mean, a different energy, different volume, but
yeah, sure.
I could, but
pretty loud.
Yeah.
My definitive Rory joke is him yelling that the moon is out during the day. He's like, you ever see the moon? You ever see when the moon is out during the day and you go, get, you're not supposed to be, he's just like yelling, get to the moon, get, anyway. So it's not that different of a value, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, but like his kind of style of kind of like you don't, it seems like he doesn't know what he's going to talk about also. Yeah.
Do you, when you go up, do you have written jokes? Do you ever go up with nothing?
Okay, see, this is where it comes into play. Now I'm also like, I want to do this. And to me, writing and honing jokes is not, it's not something I want to do. And I think it's probably because I'm lazy and have been rewarded for years of never scripting anything. So, but I've been doing like chunks about a topic and then finding stuff and then kind of like remembering to say it again, but never really having a real plan or a real set list. And that kind of puts me in a pocket that I'm comfortable in. And now... And what it took was seeing a lot of other stand-ups and realizing that the form, the art form is not just set up and punch.
Yeah.
And Rory is one of those guys for me who's like respected by set up and punchline comedians, but has the energy of like, you don't know what can happen. I don't know what can happen. And that, that makes me excited to get on stage because that activates the improviser in me, which I'm also good at and comfortable. So if I could bring some comfort with me on stage into this new format, I really and you know, I've always like hosted the improv show and like done like warm up shit, and that's always been like the highlight, and I'm like, oh, I could bring that energy into a stand-up set. And then the second someone's like, you have 10 minutes, you'll get the light at 9, I need you off in 10 minutes, I'm just dripping sweat. Like, how am I gonna fuck it? And then I go up there and I do like 8-ish minutes, see the light, get out of there, and I'm like, I think that was good. And you know, like, I and then I'm like, oh, I can't believe how much I overthought that, like going into it. I can't believe how much anxiety I had about this.
Yeah, and I should say that there's a lot of, I've interviewed 200 comedians on my podcast, Good One, let's say, and like a lot of them are lazy. So don't, you find a process that works for you, right? So it's like the benefit of writing jokes, unless you're going to be like, you know, Anthony Jeselnik type, I'm like standing here delivering jokes type comedians, and he doesn't do that anymore, is like really for a comedian starting out broadly defined, it's like internalize the rhythm of what jokes sound like.
Right.
Which
right.
you probably kind of already have. So that when you go up to write on stage, which is a term every comedian uses to describe 5,000 different processes, you are writing in stage knowing the beats of a joke just so the audience feels like they're in a joke, right? All you're trying to do is, and it's not, this is exactly like improv, right? Which is like the audience wants to feel like they're watching a show, not like they're in this sort of way station where they have this impulse to do something, right? And that's the same thing like an improv show. You can feel when they're like, the audience is like, wait, where is this headed? But not in an exciting way, but in a like lost way.
Yeah.
And a good improv show, like for the most part, you are like, oh, I'm in safe hands. This has a direction, even though we don't know what the direction is. And I think the same thing with stand-up, which is like, I'll say the exception after, which is like, oh, we're in a joke right now. Or, oh, we're on a topic right now. I know the rhythm that we're playing in.
Right.
Now you could subvert that. Or you can be a comedian who, there's some comedians, and this is less to do with, this is just kind of like certain people have the superpower where they can just go on stage and be like, blah, like Janine Garofalo, right? Or like, yes, Jen Kirkman. So it's, which is just like, they're going. And the audience is like, for whatever reason, on board. And the rhythms, where
you're
the
just
last
grabbing onto the handle of the jet ski, the water ski thing, without your skis on or anything, and you're like, I'm gonna get some water up my nose, but this is gonna be a thrill. Yeah,
yeah.
Those are there's good examples for that.
Yeah. There's only so many people can pull that off, but I do think it's like the biggest difference I think between a stand-up and other comedians is like vision and perspective, right? It's like really. Jokes are a conduit for perspective, and jokes are a conduit so the audience understands sort of like the rules the comedian operates in, sort of like
their POV, the world that this 10-minute set, this 40-minute set is taking place.
But an audience doesn't need to be like, da-da-da-da-da-da, or whatever, right?
Right,
I'm doing John Mulaney by accident. But like, they don't need the cadence, but it's like... And I personally like get like when I see a comedian doing too much of a jokey cadence, I'm like, well, you're spoon feeding an audience. You're telegraphing. You're being like, this is a joke, so you should laugh here. It's like,
right.
It's much more exciting when a comedian's like, I have my rhythm. We're gonna lock in together, right?
Yeah.
And I think improv is not different, right? But it's sort of like an improv audience is a little bit. There's two types of improv audiences. Some are like, we're here. We're part of the show too. We're here to support you. Blah blah blah. And then there's the other improv audience who goes to improv like it's a magic show where they're like, that you wrote that,
right.
That's written. So you have to win those people over. But like, I think like stand up. I think, and maybe it's increasingly so, or maybe we'll get to this, which is like it will feel like you're improvising with a partner, but the partner is the audience. Like that's kind of the goal.
Yes, It's while we're just on this topic real quick, improv and stand up. It's funny, all through my 20s in New York, this would be the early aughts, I was cutting my teeth doing improv, had a lot of friends who were stand ups just from career stuff and running into them at, you know, downtown shows and shit. And the disdain that stand ups had towards improv was like comical. And I'm fine with it. I love being in but it is ironic that do stand-ups know that crowd work is improv? And now it's like all they post is improv. A lot of stand-ups are constantly posting improv, literal improv scenes have with strangers.
Bad
in the crowd.
Improv scenes.
Yeah. And I'm like completely status blown, know who, what, and where, you know, no minimal yes anding even. But you watch it and I'm like, you were the guys who dunked on me for doing improv for a decade. And there is something funny about, like, if you're the best stand-up comic in the world, you are a millionaire and a household name. If you're the best improviser in the world, you are Andy Daly. You know what I mean? Like great fucking talented guy. But my mom knows who Dave Chappelle is. My mom doesn't know Andy
Even
Daly.
People don't watch or like a comedian will know who... who the greatest comedians, who the biggest comedians are right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you done crowd work just to see?
Yeah. It comes so easy to me.
Yeah.
It comes really easy to me because also that's kind of my sense of humor is making fun of people and them not getting too mad. I have some superpower. I think it's because I have some cartoon face and I'm not traditionally handsome that people can take fucking shots from me and they don't hate it. I think I have big brother energy and they're like, yes, I am a fucking dumpy cunt, Mr. Gamers. Just kidding. That's not the crowd work I'm doing. All right. Who in the crowd's a dumpy?
You're like, I'm great. I'm great at crowd work. And that's your example.
You're like, quick review of Gamers's crowd work album.
Because there's a type of crowd work that is not being done right now. Like so much crowd work that's being done is sort of like short reactive stuff. And both the audience and the comedian, it's like, is looking for an out. Like it's truly being like, what's your job and what's the quickest way for neither of us can do it because we want it to be a clip. But like the crowd work that I like that few people are doing is like you're almost like working the room.
Yeah,
there's a
Todd Barry's he did one special
There's a this comedian Robin Harris who he passed away before it happened. The movie Bebe's Kids was based on one of his routines.
And
he's so funny. He also played Slick Dick Willie in Do the Right Thing. He improvised all his lines. But so he was this legendary comedian, legendary black comedian from like when the idea of a black comedy club was being invented in the mid-80s, late-80s. He was placed as the master of ceremonies at this place called the Comedy Act Theater. Is that the one that's in LA? Anyway, I think so. And so every night he would host. For him, hosting would be like walking through and like, what's that haircut? Like making fun of everybody. He has and then eventually celebrities come, and the joke I write about in the book, he goes, he saw Magic Johnson and he'd be like, hey, Magic, you want to come sit in the colored section? Because like, to him, Magic Johnson was an example of a person who only hung out with white people. But there's, and you can find a clip of him on YouTube doing a version of this. And I can imagine you like treating it like a party, right? Where you're like walking through.
Yeah.
And be like, what are you drinking? Like, truly, it's so natural for you. Like that, like, and that to me is better, and you're better suited for it than like what I'm seeing when I see crowd work.
Right. Sort of. Right. And that's what appeals to me. That's fun. That's like hosting a large party that the crowd is paying to be at, and you just kind of wander around. And I that's what I'm trying to get at, so that I could, because I would like to tour solo. I mean, I've done my podcast on tour, but that always requires like a guest. I would love to tour and kind of do what is basically some chunks of stand up, some Q&A, and a bunch of audience interaction. I could fill an hour doing that, and that would I would enjoy that. Like, yes. and that's the needle I'm trying to thread. Is like, I want something that both me and both the audience and I will enjoy. Yeah. And like, there's not a ton of overlap there, you know?
I think so. But also, you want to give the audience, because you have fans that want a certain thing from you. I think the audience Q&A is like, I actually think underrated as a backdoor way of like generating material. Like it is sort of, you know, because you'll either get one of two things, which is one who like, someone will be like, what's the time you like went too far to like get something to eat or whatever. And then like, and not too far as distance, but too far as like, you shouldn't have done that. It was like 3 a.m. and blah, blah, blah. Right. And then and you're like, oh, I have a story about that. And you wouldn't even think this is a story, but the audience is telling you to go in this direction.
Yeah. I've done it a few times when I sold out like my podcast. I was like, they're like, do you want to do a second show? I'd be like, on tour, I'd be like, yeah, but the second show will be just me with a Q&A with the crowd. And so I ended up doing it in a couple of cities. And it was, some people knew funny stories. Tell the story of your first blowjob, you know, but also other people were like, hey, my boyfriend and I are blah, you know, like just throw. And I'm like, oh, this is just people are throwing me. And then it's like I'm getting a bunch of suggestions for short one person improv scenes, more or less.
Yeah. And then that's how you could, I'm like, when I suggested this, I was like, well, this would kind of also be like a coaching session with Gabrus where we're like, help you become a perfect, because it's one of my favorite things to do. Though, like, it's hard to figure out how to thread it with, like, the rest of my job of, like, being a person who, like, critiques comedy. But, like, I do feel like I now have so much perspective on how different comedians made it, how different comedians' perspective, that, like, when a comedian is, like, trying to either, like, figure out what their voice is or how to get on stage or at a much higher level, it's, like, very exciting to be, like, oh, well, how have you thought about that? This comedian does blah, 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 blah. This comedian will, like, go on stage with nothing, just, and knowing they're, like, because I'm always trying to, and this is the same thing with the book, which is, like, trying to break apart this idea that there's only one way of doing it, and there's only one way of seeing it, right? So it's like, oh, there's a million different processes you can take that, at the end, you'll be a comedian. That and seems like you.
And that's so funny you say this, because I think it's because I'm old, oldish, that, you know, I grew up watching Bud Friedman's Evening at the Improv every morning before school. And that was like how I got into stand up, was watching A&E for 1 hour day before high school in the mid to late 90s. So my idea of stand up and who I like, but now stand up has been so blown up in a way. And honestly, a lot of this stuff, like with like influencers and front-facing video comics getting to do stand up, I'm like, I'm making stand up too precious in my head.
Yeah.
And there are people who are wildly successful whose shit I do not like at all. And maybe I'll say names eventually on this pod, but I was like, why am I restricting myself? I'm holding this art form in such esteem that I'm like unwilling to participate in it. And then people like Scoville, people like, you know, Sarah Squirm, and like people who are just doing something that are like outside the norm to me, outside what I think the norm is. Speaking of norm, like Norm McDonald, like is a great example of, and so then as I see other people and I'm like, oh, well, what the fuck am I, why am I like, no, the only way to do this art form that I don't do yet is a very specific, it's like, I'm gatekeeping myself. Like I'm like getting ahead of what other people might say. And then you go and like another person, another stand-up I really like, Moses Storm. I watch Moses do like a 10 minute set and it's like, it's mostly about like a guy's beret in the crowd and it's good. And I'm like, see, this is like, I could do this, but in my head, I'm like, he's a stand-up. And I'm like, oh, no, no, no. This is shit that is like completely manageable. Yeah.
You know, and that's, it's like, you know, I often go back and forth. Like when I think about stand-up, it's useful to me to think about how like other art forms just to be like, well, like people have these rules of what paintings needed to be like. And then certain things happened and those rules were broken. And like, so it's like, Jackson Pollock was like, this is what I think a painting should be like, right? And and I'm sure there's people who saw that or like, I want to be like that, but I've studied how to make it look, that tree look just like trees or whatever. And it's like, art, to be an artist, regardless of to be a stand-up, is to be like, I'm going to express myself first. That is the goal, not to adhere to the rules of it. The rules are only useful if they help you, right? The rules provide a context. So you're like, oh, I like, if there were no rules and you wanted to stand up, you might be like, I literally don't know what happens when stand up happens. What do you do? You're like, someone's like, oh, the rules usually are there's a microphone or something, right? So then those rules help you. We're like, oh, I, you know, like if you take a stand up class, I imagine they try to explain like the basics of like what jokes are, because if you don't know where to start, but like you kind of do know where to, you know, like where to be in the middle,
right?
But you're like, you know what it'll feel like when you're like, I'm doing stand up, which will be like what it feels like for you to do improv, which is like you're flowing with the audience.
I'm in the pocket. It's working. Yeah.
And it's not about any one joke. It's about the space that you're creating. You know, like I talk about how jokes are overrated and because, and you know, I talk about the theories that exist about stand up and I, about comedy broadly. And I subscribe to this theory called play theory, which is, essentially, like, it is about the state that you're in with the audience. It is not about the single joke punchline up and down, because I don't think that's what it's like to be in a comedy audience. Because, like, a really good show, it's rolling. People are laughing just at the middle part, even though something funny wasn't saying. Like, if that's the goal, and you, because you've done improv, you know what that feels like. So in many ways, it's like you don't have to think about jokes as the end goal, right? You don't think you need to think of a punchline as an end goal. It's almost like you need to think of a setup that puts you in the space to play.
Right. So and the end goal is the crowd laughing. Like the end goal is
there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And you're connecting with them. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So I listen to this podcast, I listen to other podcasts. It's like, you've had like five episodes about sandwiches or whatever, right? Yeah. And it's like, you could do a one-person show about sandwiches. Hypothetically, if someone goes like, what's your history with sandwiches, right? If someone used it to Q&A, someone said that, I bet you could talk about that for an hour. I don't know if...
Yeah, I don't know if it would be like banging material the whole time, but I could easily fill an hour. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, you just need to be in the space of like... And then, so then you do that and then you just talk and you, like, what a comedian might do is like record it and be like, oh, that one phrase locked in.
Right.
Oh, maybe I can make a whole thing out of that one part of it. Like, what was I trying to say? Like, the most extreme process I talk about is like the Chris Rock process. So like Chris Rock bombed so much still. Like I've seen, the first time I saw Chris Rock perform, I was like 19. He came into the Comedy Cellar to work on, or maybe 18, 17, I don't know, to work on the MTV Music Award monologue. And he bombed for 10 minutes. And he's like, okay, bye. I was like, the show's going to be terrible. And then it was incredible, right? And then I saw him 15 years later, whatever. I'm a full adult. I'm at Night Train, the Why Snack show. And they're like, hey, everyone put away your phones. If we see your phone out, we're going to throw you out. And I was like, oh, who's it going to be, right? And like, okay, here's Chris Rock. And Chris Rock comes out and he's wearing his coat. He doesn't take his coat off. He's talking super quiet. He's not making eye contact at all with the audience. He's looking down. And he just says, he's talking only about his divorce the entire hour. And he just like says something and it either gets a reaction or it doesn't. If it does get a reaction, if the audience laughs, he then cuts off the laugh. He goes, so what else? What else? So then the momentum complete. So he's bombing essentially on purpose.
Yes, he's not Chris Rocking it up yet.
So he's doing it just so he knows what actually does not need Chris Rock to sell it. These are ideas that can sell themselves. Yeah. So when he Chris Rocks them.
Yeah, when it works in a vacuum, in quotes. Like if it like works just on paper, then imagine Chris Rock doing it. And imagine one of those things that gets a laugh and Chris Rock repeating it 15 times yes, with exactly. stomping his foot. And, you know, like I'm here for it. I'm here for it the whole way. One of the best of all time.
Yeah, so now not all comedians like bombing. That it is hard. There's some comedians, but I think like being afraid of bombing too much, like a right amount is good because it makes you like, I got to work. Otherwise, I'm going
to bomb. Don't want to bomb. Yeah. I'm trying to deliver something nice. Yeah.
But a lot of bad comedy happens when a comedian's like, I never want to bomb ever again. I essentially have a traumatic relationship with bombing. So I'm going to create this defensive armor where whatever works, I'm going to just crush 10 minutes. And then the audience doesn't know who I am. I don't know what the audience is. They will think I'm funny, but they won't remember a name. But at least I won't let myself vulnerable. So it's like, but really the vulnerability is like where the comedians we think of as like the great comedians and also like the comedy that lasts with us has some version. And it doesn't have to be just like, oh, that was so vulnerable they talked about.
It doesn't have to be personal. It doesn't have to be like introspective or deep even. It's just, you know that the person, this is pure, like whatever that might mean.
So if you look like when Rory's improvising, a lot of it, it's like about like, I feel like I talked to him and it's like this joke about porn that was like so specific, but it's like such a mind of a person not filtering what they're telling people.
Right.
And you're like, that is scary, right? Like, it's not like revealing it. It's not sad, but it truly is just sort of like, it's almost kind of like it's dumb, but it's exactly like his brain being brought to the audience's brain. That's an option. Or like the example I like to think is like Christian Schaal will like have premises that like, is no one's idea of what comedy looks like, but it's exactly her premise and goes, this is what I think is funny. This is who I am in my soul.
Yeah.
And even though it seems silly to put forward exactly what your soul is a scary thing to do. If it was scary, more people would do it.
Right. Exactly. The harsh sounds of quiet is just so difficult to deal with that you have to.
Yeah.
We on them Athletic Greens. Oh, my digestion and focus and everything is feeling better. You know, longtime listeners, we've been talking about AG1 for however many years on this podcast now. I'm still on my AG1. I've been traveling a little bit. I got my travel packs with me. I have my bag in my home base. I am not missing my daily AG1. It's a super simple, easy, way to get your multivitamins in. Every scoop includes prebiotics, probiotics, and digestive enzymes. All that stuff I need that isn't in traditional multis. So I get it all, including vitamin Bs, my vitamin Cs, a little zinc for immune health. I love it. I got a few friends. Actually, I'm mad at them. They didn't use my AG1 promo code, but I got them started on Athletic Greens as a morning routine because I sold them the same way I'm trying to sell you guys. It's just a simple, basic, easy step. You start your day off with smashing down, before you even have coffee, smash down your AG1, and then boom, you're in. You've got your vitamins, your prebiotics, probiotics ready to start the day with a basic, easy intro to a healthy lifestyle, interesting way to start your day. Nice, simple, healthy. It works, okay? AG1 is the supplement I trust to provide the support my body needs daily. And that's why they've been a partner for so long. Truly. I hope they never leave advertising my podcast because I actually really enjoy their product. If you want to take ownership of your health, it starts with AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/mighty. That's drinkag1.com/mighty. DRINKAG, the number one, .com/MIGHTY. Check it out. Got to make sure my friends, next time they get Athletic Greens, they use my promo code. You struggle to save money every month? Let me guess. Yes, since pretty much everyone has that problem. But with Rocket Money, you can quickly identify all those sneaky subscriptions that keep charging you month after month. Did you accidentally hold on to an old meditation app, or are you have like a double booking of a streamer because you moved in with your partner and now you're paying? I'm leaving out brand names here, but that's exactly what happened to me. And cancel any of the ones you don't want to use anymore. It's an easy way to start saving money. Over 80% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, money that's just going to waste. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps you lower your bills all in one place. With Rocket Money, easily cancel the ones you don't want with just the press of a button. No long hold times or annoying emails with customer service. Rocket Money does all that work for you. You can even negotiate to lower your bills by up to 20%. All you got to do is take a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Woo! With over 5 million users and counting, Rocket Money has helped save its customers an average of $720 a year and $1 billion in total savings so far. Dang, homie. Any more money than that, and you can buy yourself any app you want and trash it. Stop wasting my money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions and manage your money the easy way by going to rocketmoney.com/mighty. That's rocketmoney.com/mighty. rocketmoney.com/mighty. Mighty. A lot of what we're talking about is the art form expanding and the tent of stand-up getting way larger. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like what Kat Cohen is doing is stand-up. What, you know, like, and there's, it's just a lot of new kind of ideas. And that is appealing to a lot of people. But I think a lot of, you know, people who've been in the business, who've been doing it for a long time, frown upon that. Because it's like, no, that's, but it reeks of like, you know, no shotgun formation in football. That's not real football. California, like 5 wide receivers. That's not, you know, it starts to feel like, no, it's just working for them. Yeah. So I feel the reticence to be like, I don't know if that's real stand up. And I'm like, but wait, you don't even want to do real stand up. Like, and
that, it's exactly that little thing where it's like, well, I don't know if this counts as the real stand-up. It's like, you don't even want to be a real stand-up, but you hold yourself to a standard that you don't apply.
Right. And it's so complicated. And I guess that's just me, like, projecting onto other people. You know, it's like me projecting onto, like, Brian Regan seeing my set and being like, that's not stand-up. That's not stand-up. You know, like, and it absolutely shattering me, you know? But it's so open now. It's so different. Like, I did a night at the Improv main stage, and there was like 12 great comics.
Yeah.
And like Craig Robinson came up and put a fan on and played the piano and did like random fucking like almost like little sketches. He did like 7 little sketches in 10 minutes. Kumail came up and did like just new material. Adam Conover came up and did what you would think Adam Conover might do comedy about. It was funny. It's energetic. It's about public transportation, you know? And then like Moses Storm comes up and fully does an improvised set. Jeremiah Watkins does what, and you're like, oh, like someone came up and played like a full 90 seconds of a song and kind of weirdly moved to it. And it weirdly worked and it set a tone. And I'm like, this is, you know, because I came up doing like Wild and Out and Guy Code. So I was around a lot of black comics a long time, you know, and you would hear like Stool Humpers and stuff like that. You would hear these like, and it's like 90 seconds of music and reacting to it out of a 10-minute set is weird. on paper, but it worked. So then why is it wrong? Like, and then in my head, and I'm holding this to like a fake idea of what I think stand up. I'm like, not everyone's going to be Stephen Wright, obviously.
Yeah, but it's, and also like when Stephen Wright was doing that, I'm sure there are guys in Boston be like, that guy's not doing real stand up.
Right, yeah.
So I think it's a few things, right? I think one of it, it's like, I always say the rules, a lot of the rules of comedy were created by like failed road dogs in the 80s who were resentful of the people who were successful. So then they created rules that they beat into younger comedians because that essentially built a value system around themselves. Right. But they're like, real comics are guys like me, not like whoever was famous, right? And I think that is part of it. I think, I remember around Nanette came out, Moshe Kasher was like, so many comedians are so insecure that what we do even is art that they will attack anyone doing it differently. And I think that is then supported by the scarcity mindset of like Hollywood in general, which is like, which is legitimate, which is if you're not relevant, we actually might stop working with you. Like it actually does happen. So it's not wild for like a what we think of as comic-y comic who like was really good in the, you know, even 20 years ago, like, and like had Comedy Central Presents and was like the one of the dudes or whatever. And this is mostly, I think of mostly guys when I think of this type of comedian.
Yeah, I'm thinking leather jackets when you say this. So,
I think of, there are hacky female comedians as well, but like the hackiest comedians are these type of dudes. And it's like, so, and then they see a person singing a song or whatever, and they're like, that's not real stand-up. And the truth is, they're either paranoid or correct that this thing is going to replace them.
Right.
Now, they could do the opposite, which is like, oh, this is where it's going. How can I reconcile what I do into a world like this? Does this open things up for me? Hey, but that demands a certain amount of self-awareness and reflection that is hard to do, especially when you've been doing for a long time.
Yeah, agreed.
Like, I crush every night. Why do I gotta do this now? It's like, you don't have to, but if you want to have fans like that, you might need to do what they like. And especially if you like came up at a time where like the audience was resented and not a time where audiences, like I think one of the best things that like improv and UCB brought to stand-up was not necessarily resenting the audience right away.
Not kicking off with an antagonistic relationship with your crowd. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that, and if you, you know, and look, that I go back and forth because sometimes crowds do suck, but if I was talking to an audience, I'd be like, this is what you got to do to be a better audience. But to comedians, like, the audience is doing their best. They've never been an audience before. So, like, work together. And, like, you got into this because, well, there's a variety of reasons you got into it. The truth is some people got into it because they liked the feeling of being funny, right? And they liked the feeling of laughter. Some people got into it because they like comedy. And so the idea of, like, being able to be expansive is exciting. But, like, to me, the comedians that are most exciting are the ones who understand the potential of a more broad definition of what they can do, which doesn't mean they have to stop doing. If you know, like, as I say, like, there are still people who paint realist paintings. There's still buildings that look like classic architecture.
Right.
There are still
road dog grindy setup punch.
That's still allowed.
Yeah.
And it's not going to go away.
Right. And like you're saying, the person who like resents the guitar comic briefly or whatever, it's like, well, if you're okay with selling the amount of tickets you're selling as doing you, then you can be your pure format or whatever. Yeah. And that's kind of what I need to get in my head too, of like, I'm like, I don't need to shoot in South Africa and Baltimore and cut it together for my hour long. Like, I could just go on tour and sell 100 tickets to small venues. And that is what I would be happy doing right now. Yeah. If I blew up, that would be fucking great. But I'm aiming, you know, you're like, you get in your head of like, well, if guitar comics can do it, like now I'm a dead man in the water. It's like, no, you have people at your show. The guitar comic has people at their show. Like it's all, Nanette is a great example. Cause I feel like when Nanette hit, it was a kind of trigger point for, a lot of other kind of dialogue around, because it was already, we were getting into like, relax, guys, we're just supposed to be telling jokes. But it also got into a lot of like, these people, mostly guys, getting podcasts and voicing their opinions a lot and seeing rewards for having similar opinions to their listeners or their patrons. And then you find that now they get, not only do they have the ego of getting laughs, now they have the ego of having like supporters who agree with their perspective. And then that expands outside of comedic premises into politics, social commentary, pop culture. And then you find these comics who will get, and I'm one of them. I'm up my own ass about being a bit of a tastemaker and having, I think I have good, strong opinions like a lot of comics do, but I don't think, I'm still just trying to make people laugh in the end. You know what I mean? Like, I do think that there's been this newfound thing. And it's a two-way street between the audience and the performer that we both hoisted this upon the format, in that it's like, I don't agree with this person's politics. And it's like, but are they funny? Like, are you what? Like, here's something I'll say here. Shane Gillis's hour is good.
A lot of people like Shane Gillis is the example most people bring up, because Shane is a much better comedian than the other people that he like hangs out with.
Yes, yes.
So it's like, easy to be like
the other people that he's caught up in that he gets like painted with the same broad strokes, but he's a very good stand up. Yeah,
yeah, I think so. Also, he, it's easier to say when someone's better at it, but like there are other comedians of that ilk who have embraced the potential of like the dark side money of like, let some people think I'm like a pro-Trump comedian just so I can get all their money, even though my politics aren't that. But a lot of those comedians became worse because they were just playing to this audience that wanted them to like comment about how the vaccine was silly or something.
Yeah.
But like, the thing about that, this idea of the politics, what I find often that happens, if not more often, is the reverse happens, where a comedian, where an audience member will find a person funny and then be like, I guess I agree with their politics, which is like a funny thing to think about. But like, they're, like it happens much more often because you're sort of, you don't know what a lot of, most people don't go into a show, be it Shane Gillis or sort of anyone on Netflix, knowing like, oh, I read this article about them in the New Republic and blah, blah, blah. They're just like, seems like a person who does stand up. Yeah, and they watch, it's like, this is really funny. And then they're like, what do you think of him? I was like, you know, oh, actually, he's alt-right. I'm not saying he is, but like, let's say that. They're like, I guess I'm alt-right.
Like, yeah, right. Like, I adopted everything about this then. I really enjoyed Shang Wang's special. I agree with him on all politics now. It's like, I don't even know what they are.
Yeah, I just like, he talked about this issue that I care about, so I'm going to repeat it. Like, I remember Elon Musk showed up at a Dave Chappelle show, and everyone booed him, and I remember people being like, what? Dave Chappelle fans and Elon Musk fans are like a complete circle Venn diagram. And it's like, no, that's what you think of it. But to a Dave Chappelle fan, they think Dave Chappelle is not like an Elon Musk person. Right. He's like, but you're like, it's not an outsider. It's like, you're in it. You're like, Dave's funny. What he says is cool. I trust he has the views on these issues that I think he has. So it's, you can be like, what? Dave's not X-phobic. And you're like, but it's like, how do you know? It's like, well, come on, he's Dave. He's a good guy.
Like, okay.
Well, from an outsider, a person who might say all these things to them might seem like a bad guy. Now, I don't know what's in his heart. This is all, and we don't need to get to that. But the point being, like, you know, Nanette had so many things working both for it and against it. And I think, one, it's like, it is radical. It's a radical thing to do, to be like, I'm going to just stop being funny, and he didn't realize I was going to do that. That's like, no one does that, right? And now more comedians will do it. Look, Dave Chappelle does it now. Dave Chappelle will go giant stretches without being funny at all.
Yeah, tell some long, prolonged story about a pimp to get like
or like even he did 846, right? Which was impressive thing, but like that was less funny than Nanette was. And, but also, I like, to me, Nanette was interesting because of that formal decision to like revoke laughs. But I know it gets associated as like post Trump electing, like virtue singling comedy, which like, I think like I don't know many comedians that like can do stand up, especially where they're just virtue singling for an hour. That like, maybe
It's almost stand-up is almost exclusively virtue signaling, just depending on what your virtues are. You're signaling your own virtues, more or less.
But I meant without jokes.
The
only comedians I think of like truly being like, we're here for just vibes, is like a comedian like Jerrod Carmichael, who's trying to do like a third thing, which is like, let's redefine what we think of a show is.
Yeah.
But like, that's because... But no one is like really, no one's actually doing a TED Talk. No one's doing like, you showed up to a comedy show and be like, here's a slideshow presentation just about like Me Too, the Me Too movement.
Yeah, here's some like belief system I have and I'm going to sell you
most
on it. Yeah.
People, because most people doing comedy had to come up as a comedian. So the desire to do that is, it is so hard to make it as a comedian that you have to have something propelling you to do it. And part of it is that you like saying things funny out loud and having audience response.
Some of it is family money.
Some of it is family money. But, so even Hannah Gatsby, like, you don't do a show where you're like, this is the problem with stand-up, if you don't think and care about stand-up, right?
It's right,
like,
yeah.
You don't do that being like, I hate stand-up so much, it's so boring and stupid. You're like, you do it. You clearly, like, you don't like a lot of the same conventional wisdom that you push back against. Like, I think almost everyone, like the example I compare Hannah Gatsby to in the book is Patrice O'Neill, right? Though you can't think of two people that I think a lot of people would put so far apart from each other.
Right.
And if Patrice was alive now, I'm sure he would hate Hannah Gatsby. But they both, like, there's a documentary about Patrice called Killing is Easy. And Patrice would be like, I can kill any night. It's easy. It's stupid. Hacks can kill. Killing is boring. What's interesting is like really pushing people. Here's my perspective on things.
This is a guy who does it.
And he does it. Now he does it by being like, women should be subservient to men or whatever. But he's doing the same thing, which is like, I don't need to kill. I got a point I need to make. That's what Hannah Gatsby did. Now, Hannah doesn't dress like Patrice does and like have that certain sort of like masculine gravitas in that same way. But like their instinct is the same, which is like how people define stand-up is too limiting for me. So fuck that. Because I got into comedy to be like, fuck a regular job where I have preconceived notions of what I'm supposed to do.
Right. Man, it's so funny because the comics I loved coming up too, like I came up listening to Opie and Anthony and Shock Jocks and stuff. So in my teens, I was like a diehard Opie and Anthony fan and then a Politically Incorrect fan. So I'm like, you know, I was like, I loved Norton, Geraldo, Patrice, Colin Quinn. Like I loved I still love a lot of those people. A few of them have aged poorly despite everything. But I've always looked to those people. Jumping back to something you said earlier, you mentioned like people get their politics from someone they like or whatever. Something I've noticed a few, and this is just a minor thing, but I'm trying to find a tenuous connection here. On like the Action Boys podcast, we don't have a ton of listeners, but they're pretty loyal. We have a few thousand. They agree with a lot of us, with a lot of the stuff we say about movies and stuff. But when they don't agree with us, it really seems to fuck them up.
Yeah.
But they're like, wait, you don't like the movie Logan? But I like the movie Logan and I like you guys. And it's like, this has no bearing on our dynamic. Yeah. Like we just said, it's a subjective form, but the way it breaks people, it kills people that we don't love the new Marvel movies. Like it really fucks with our crowd that they're like, oh, here they go, just shitting on special effects again. And it's like, they're all really worked up about it. And I want to be like, it doesn't matter what we like, but I understand that. Like if you grew up like loving Will Ferrell and Will Ferrell's like, I hate The Simpsons, you'd be like,
yeah,
but I love you and The Simpsons. And it's like,
but I think that's like, that's partly like, I think the ideal dynamic is like what your relationship would be with your friends, right? Which is like, you don't have to agree with your friends and then that's fun. But I do think partly because of fandom being passed through the internet, it's much more one-to-one. And you're like, you are me. You're not my friend, John. You are literally me. You're John and you're me. So when I listen to podcasts, it's a conversation I am having. And so I do think when you don't agree with them, you're like, then who am I? And it's like, you're you. You're a friend. Whatever. And I do think that's an internet problem. I do think like the internet has made it so the identifying with a comedian or any artist is...
It like comes with the perils of their personality now, yeah, too, where it's like, oh, you like Dua Lipa's music? Well, did you know that she was in a hit and run accident where she like, this is not true. She like dinged another person's car or something. And you're like, wait, why am I on trial for that? It's like, you said you liked Dua Lipa. I'm like, I don't fundamentally co-sign like everything. Like I love Dave Chappelle. I don't agree with a lot of his opinions.
Yeah.
And it's making it harder to watch, not because I disagree with him, but because he digs in a not funny way on something I disagree with. So it's like a double hit to me. But that doesn't mean I'm writing him off as not a talented stand-up or not a funny person anymore. Like, but it feels like now there's like this element to like everyone has to be perfect and not necessarily perfect. Like it's a sliding scale of what perfect is based on the audience member, based on the consumer. Of like, oh, I loved Killers of the Flower Moon, but I thought these five things were wrong with it, so I can't. And it's like, wait, that's not how art works. Like, it's not delivered for you. Yeah,
but it is. This is the problem. The problem is like almost all arguments that exist around comedy, probably all art forms. It is a correlation without causation, which is like actually the real factor is the internet has completely skewed our relationship to the content we consume. Even if we wouldn't say this explicitly, you go on TikTok and you're like, well, everything on TikTok I like. So why would I want, you know, like, so I do think people are actively trying to prune things. Like, I do think, there's this feeling, I watch too much stuff. There's so many comedians I like. I actually, this person disagrees with me on that. I don't need them anymore. And right, then for relief, it feels good.
There's an abundance. There's an abundance of stuff where you're like, great, I don't have to watch this anymore because I've realized there's some stuff I don't like about it. Thank God.
Yeah, and I do think that, I think, you know, the problem, there's so many problems with gatekeepers, obviously, but there was obviously, I do think something beneficial to like, we all watch the same stuff and then as a result, we'll have different opinions about, you know, Chris Rock and then we can argue even, or different positive opinions and then we can have a conversation next to each other. We're like, blah, blah, blah. But like, I do think, we are turning all artists, comedians sort of being so singular gets the most of it, which is like, oh, the audience is just becoming like a reflection of the comedian in a way that is creates sort of feedback loop that I don't think is like conducive to comedians, right?
Yes,
like especially as they get more famous, like they are only appealing to sort of a certain person. And I think that's probably not as good. And like, but there's no end in sight of that. I don't know how to fix it. That's an internet problem. That's not an art problem.
Right. But also it's like, it's an economics problem too, because the person, the performer needs a fan base, needs people to that so that they can keep doing it and keep the lights on in their house. So it becomes this complicated relationship of like, well, I don't know if my crowd would like this, you know what I mean? And now people are like, now you're performing. Like, obviously, the end goal is making the audience laugh / like you / want to come back or, you know, but if you are like, if you're aiming exclusively for that, you're losing your sense of self too, in a way, like, and it's a wild time out there too. And I think like Patreon is amazing and I thank God for it or else I'd be unhoused at this point. But it is also like you're needing less and less of a crowd. And I think it's cool. It's splintered the art form in a way where if you're like a really great single panel comic artist and you got 400 people that are willing to pay, you can live off. You know what I mean? Like, and that's really exciting. But I do think that makes us kind of like aim for the targets that would work in a weird way rather than like, what do I want to say? It's more like, what do people want to hear?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. And I think, and it's always a balance. I think comedians are always balancing between the audience that trusts them and they trust and allows them to sort of expand and feel safe, and the audience outside of that. And I think who pushes back on them and demands them expand their thinking, right? All comedians are, at least stand-up, are always trying to figure that out. And there's perils in sort of too much safety. There's perils in too much antagonism.
Right.
Like, where you're just combative, you're not doing anything, right? So it's hard. And I do think it becomes worse when the thing that your audience wants from you is, like, actually not even what you want to express, but just sort of a thing that they decided you are. You are this to me. You don't have, if you don't do that, I'm not going to pay you for it. I'm paying for this access. And you're like, I guess, you know, like, audiences are a reflection of their crowds, right? So it's like, you know, we're on your message board using words, these words. That's the shit we like.
Yeah, you better use this in your set. Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I don't even have a problem with these people. But, like, that's, and, you know, comedians are, you know, I don't think this is out of step to say they are a needy bunch.
Yes. Well, so, a majority of us got into it because needing attention or laughter or love.
Yeah, yeah. So then the goal with the book is, like, I say better audiences, better, you know, better, better ingredients, better pizza, and comedy is made up from the audience. So, like, better audience, better comedy. So it's like, so if I can make both the comedians and the audience think a little bit deeper about this, maybe the work itself become deeper because of the loop. Like, I don't just, I'll go to shows and critique audiences and be like, they're into this too much. They need to be like, now, what value does it have? I don't know. But, like,
but right, I think, open your minds up, guys.
Yeah, I think, and right now, audiences are still remembering how to be an audience. Like, still post-pandemic, they're still remembering
how to be in public, period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's wild. And I'm like, no, they're still figuring out. Like, it's hard to process, and this is a space, and, like, they're doing their best, but, like, because I remember what comedy was like not so long pre-pandemic, and, like, it was really, like, thriving, and lots of different comedians can do that, and, like, killing didn't just look like one thing, and people can really go out on a limb. So that's the goal. It's like, I want to go get back there as soon as possible.
Don't we all? Well, this feels like a natural time to, like, get into plugging the comedy book here. So talk to us. Talk to my shithead listeners about the book.
Yeah, the book's called Comedy Book. It's a book. It's 11 chapters. Each chapter is an idea of comedy broadly defined. It's somewhat abstract. So, like, a chapter is about timing, but it's not about, like, when you say a joke. It's about sort of the timing in which you say, when in the context of time are you saying your joke? How close to a national tragedy? How we use comedy to process tragedies, right? Then global tragedies. But then there's a chapter called Connection, which is, like, how I and other people might use comedy to process personal tragedies. Or there's a chapter about truth, right? Which was a sort of abstract idea, I thought, but now is an extremely relevant idea because of the hostage.
It's a hot topic out of
which
nowhere.
Which is, like, how do you think, how to think about truth in comedy, which, no matter what, we just, like, that's a guy up there and he's just saying his thing, or she's just saying her story, and or whatever. And then, like, no, actually, like, they're an artist, and they created a thing based on their true life, and what they decide, how they hedge it was based on how the audience responded to a story, and it's a much more sort of abstract understanding of truth. So, like, that, I'll explore that. It's all kind of about comedy over the last 40 years. I think the book is pretty funny. I try to write jokes in it, so it's not just, like, an academic book, but, like, the goal is you leave it appreciated in comedy more deeply. And, like, I don't know if you'll laugh more often, but you'll be able to like more comedians. You'll be able to laugh deeper because you'll have a sort of more intellectual relationship, like a deeper intellectual relationship with it. And also, like, as I said, the goal of this book is for there to be more books like this. Like, there hasn't really
been. This is the shit we were saying right when I started. Like, I wish there were more people looking at it from this perspective that you are. And I'm glad that there's a book that can help people enrich both their performing and in consumption of stand-up. Like, just like, you know, read a film theory book and maybe you get a deeper love out of movies, you know, if you're a fan, right? Like, it makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I think it's, like, it's worked. Look, the thing I say is, like, I actually cut out this joke because no one knew the hair care for men slogan, but I was like, I'm not just the CEO, I'm also a client or whatever, which is like, I know it works. I've been only thinking about comedy for 13 years or whatever, and I've not got, I find it continuously interesting, where I know people, especially as you get older, you're like, all young comedians are bad. I only like these 10 people that have the exact same references I do. It's like, right. Well, actually, what if you liked a comedian 15 years younger than me? Because like they capture something new, or they're your way for even understanding young people. And it's like, it's like you'll like comedy more. Your money back is what I promise you. Though I've been told I can't get money back, but like
smart, it's not a lot that you're gonna get anyway. So do you, it is a book after all.
So,
it's not a Patreon podcast where you tickle the right wing third rail where you can make the real.
That's the next book.
That's the joke we always make on our Patreon too. It's like, you know, we could just start being anti-vax and triple our money in like no time.
Easy. Oh my God. Before they all hid their Patreon numbers, I wrote down the Patreon numbers, how much money those shows were making a month. And it's like, oh boy, that is wild.
It's insane. It's brutal. It's crazy.
Buy the book and learn how much money Tim Dillon makes a month.
I mean, I know. I kept track. Fellow Long Islander. A guy who, again, a guy who I disagree with on just about every single thing he says, but I do still find him funny.
Yeah, though I think his special is hindered by the fact of who his audience is.
Yeah.
A lot of times, if you get a bad audience, like, this is it's a can of worms of a conversation, but like, there are certain comedians whose audiences have gotten worse in my definition of what worse is. And their comedy is like, it becomes almost claptery for the other side, right? It's like struggling to be themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Jesse, you have the podcast, Good One, about jokes and interviews with stand-ups, which I'm a big fan of as well. So listeners, check Jesse out there. Check out his book. He's an author now. And as for me, check out the aforementioned Action Boys, a Patreon podcast. Help me keep the lights on. And as always, bye, shitheads.
That was a HeadGum podcast.
In a part of the world where there are no rules.
Holy shit.
Holy shit, guys. Holy, I'm so pumped.
I definitely have not watched this since I rented it on VHS in 92.
Strangers united by the threat of death.
We got all the fucking major players. Seagal.
Vladimir Putin is a good man.
Arnold.
Here, come. Give it to me.
I need you to cream pie me now.
Stallone. People are loving this movie.
It's actually, it's got a lot of heart.
You're mentally irregular.
Now. Somewhere, somehow, someone's gonna pay.
I would fucking love for my wife to like see me rip a guy's throat out.
But they didn't count on one thing.
This movie's fucking insane.
It's how you know it's a good movie. You have to do almost all the work yourself to figure it out.
Well, there's a fantasy component. Yeah. There's some sword fighting.
There's some lightning.
Bam, 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 bam.
There's a new game in town.
You wake up after a few years, and then you don't even know who you are anymore.
We're going to be making Terminators.
We're going to make a really great deal with the Xenomorphs.
What? I don't hate them, but I've been in a room.
Yes, I understand.
This is now the 20th ending of the movie.
I am Dar.
I'm your dad.
Action Boys. Boys will be boys.
Subscribe here for bonus content and more free stuff from behind the paywall. To get new episodes, become a patron at actionboys.biz.
Do it! Do it!
Come on! Do it now!